Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Now, my next guest is the man usually in a bowler hat with an accent from a different planet. BP Fallon is a true rock and roll renaissance man. He started his career as a teenager when RTE Radio was still in the GPO. Then he becomes a DJ.
RT Radio. Well, Radio Aaron.
Oh, he's correcting me already.
Fact fans.
Radio Aaron, indeed. Yeah. And then you became a DJ, music journalist, author, broadcaster, publicist, and finally musician, working with the biggest names, John Lennon, Mark Bolan along the way. You did PR. We'll get into it, BP. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
You're more than welcome. It's this to me, I must say, very early in the morning.
Oh, sorry.
I'm kind of nocturnal.
We should have pre-recorded at midnight.
No, we shouldn't. It's better to be live. And first of all, thank you for having me.
Not at all. You're doing us a favour coming in here, and very excited to get into your story. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not going to be in the next Olympics, probably. But I'm here, which is a continuing miracle. And long may it continue. I'm not ready to go celestial.
You don't want to leave the party?
Well, I've things to do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, things to do.
Music to make.
So I can't, music to make. So I can't leave now.
You can't leave now. Yeah. I read somewhere that you, in recent years, were living between Dublin, New York, Austin, Texas.
Austin.
Are you still doing that?
Well, Austin is mainly for music.
Yeah.
There's a studio I like there very much. And of course, you're not short of musicians in Austin. Although I was recording there and I rang up John Sheehan from the Dubliners, you know.
Yeah.
I said, I'm surrounded by fiddle players here in Texas, but I'd really like you to add your magic to the record. So consequently, he put his fiddle on some tracks. Now I've lost the drift of what I'm talking about.
Well, but this is your whole life, isn't it? You're constantly ringing up people who are of note in music and you seem to hypnotise them into doing, bowing to your will.
Don't be telling trade secrets. No, people are very kind, you know. And in my moments of doubt, I think, well, they may be my friends, but they wouldn't be making music with me if they thought it was rubbish, you know. And these are some pretty high-profile people, you know. So I'm very gratified that, that these people give of their art and their heart.
Can we go back to the beginning of your life, if we may, just to to go for a little trip with you? Because you're born at the Second World War has just ended, which is important in your life, isn't it? Because your dad is
my father was in the army, God bless him.
In the British Army.
Yeah.
And are you 3 years old? He brings you to Germany.
He was a colonel, actually.
Oh, was he?
What was it?
When you're 3 years old, you go to Germany,
about
don't you?
3 years old.
Are there any fuzzy memories even of that time?
Yes. I remember as a toddler looking out the window of the train and just seeing for miles rubble everywhere, bits of smoke coming out of it here and there, and these unfortunate people digging in it, looking for God knows what, find anything, you know. And so, of course, I didn't know the terminology at the time, but I was suddenly witnessing, and because of witnessing, also being part of something horrible. So without going to Mississippi, I knew what the blues was from then on in.
Wow.
You know.
Extraordinary memories to have. Then you come back to England, obviously, with your family, and you're into the private school system there. Was that a tough place to be for you?
Ampleforth was populated with these very well-educated, self-satisfied Benedictine monks. And the thrust of their, what they were teaching us, is that we were gentlemen, and our job was to treat the plebs as well as we could.
Wow.
You know, now, I didn't buy into that. This is one of the problems.
Clearly.
But it was incredible that people could believe that or at least teach it. But what it did is it, you know, Ampleforth was sort of, they called it the Catholic Eden, you know. Mm-hmm. What it did to people who bought into it, it gave them a sense of confidence. It gave them a sense of entitlement. So when they went into, for the interview, they'd be calm and collected, and the interviewer would be kind of nervous because of their
I see.
Bollocks, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's no wonder that so many people were prime minister in England who went to Eton. Mm. Because you're, they put this stuff in your head.
The superiority complex is taught there.
That you are superior.
In this time, who's your mum, by the way?
My mum is Kitty Fallon, God bless her. Ah. She comes from a family in near Kells.
All right.
And for a horsey family, you could say.
Yeah.
And then my father was a professional soldier for 30 years. You know, he was tail end of empire when places were throwing off the yoke of Britain. He was in the Khyber Rifles, for instance.
Wow. Was he stoical? Did he talk about his time as a soldier?
Sometimes did, you know. But I've realised a lot of old soldiers don't talk about stuff.
No.
You know. But I'm very much admired both of my parents. And both of my parents were incredibly kind to me. They never prohibited me doing anything.
Did they live long enough to see you go through the rock and roll trip that you did?
Yes, they did. They did the beginnings of it, if you like. Apparently my father fell off the sofa when he saw me in John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band on Top of the Pops. Chuffed, you know, that there's his son with a Beatle kind of thing. You know?
Oh, great. They're the moments you look forward to.
Well, you see, I was going along a path that wasn't familiar to my parents at all.
Okay.
You know, yeah. My father went to Trinity and then joined the army.
Mm-hmm. You were the opposite, really. You broke all the rules.
Kind of an opposite, you know.
When you left the private system in Brittany, mercifully came to Dublin.
A place called St. Condis.
Yeah, it's still there.
Which, first of all, was a day school.
Ah.
So I could go out at night without being punished, which was a new thing.
Did you get along with the kids there?
No, they didn't like me at all.
No,
they disliked me quite intensely.
Because you were a rocker?
Well, one reason is because I seemed to be meeting girls with greater facility than they were. So that's bound to...
That puts you in unpopular.
Somewhere.
I thought that would make you popular, but anyway. Yeah. You become a reviewer, don't you, in this as a teenager?
I reviewed records and stuff like that, and gigs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would be any good as a journalist because I'm too opinionated. So I call myself a writer in that context. Yeah. I know it's pompous and overblown, but there you are.
But you knew exactly what you were going to set out to do. What is it, 1964?
Well,
Radio Picking the Pops. You're the teenage reviewer there.
Yeah, 1964. Telefischeren, only been going a couple of weeks then, years, I mean. And if you were the newsreader, and I'm not being rude about the newsreader, but if you were the newsreader, you couldn't walk down Henry Street without being mobbed.
Oh, right, so, they were famous.
You know, I was one of the kids representing them, if you like, in among all these old folkies who hadn't got a clue, you know.
And radio steered music, didn't it, in those
radio
days?
Radio was very important then.
So you become a DJ on the early stages of Radio Éireann. What was that like in the Ireland of that time?
Oh, it was wonderful because they let me do whatever I wanted to do. They didn't say you have to play this record and da-da-da. Mm-hmm. So consequently, you know, I was influenced by John Peel. So I'd play, let's say, Country Joe and the Fish, followed by Sandy Denny, Who Knows Where the Mind Goes, followed by Turkish flute music or something, you know, carte blanche.
You were edgy.
Well, I was edgy twice enough for the establishment there to tell me off. I got a copy of Nashville Skyline. There were two in England. George Harrison had one and Julie Felix had another. I borrowed her one. And this show I'm talking about was half an hour. And all of the record still left time for another track. So I put in a rockabilly thing, which was Dylan's first single. That was withdrawn when people were seeing as a folk singer. Mixed Up Confusion. I got mixed up confusion. Okay. The piano going mad, you know.
Yeah.
And then, so I was told off for playing that because of the lines I lay across my big brass bed.
Shocking in 1960s Ireland.
You know, maybe they were married.
Yeah, exactly. You made the front page of the Irish Catholic at some point. I'm sure that was very important for your cool credentials.
Well, I was quite chuffed by their slagging of me, actually, because if you have a controversy, people get more involved.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know? And I realised very quickly that if people dislike you, it's quite possible that other people do like you, you know. And so there's this, you know, and the arty guy took a picture of my hair to show people how incredibly long it was.
Now, if that was
you
a
looked
fascination.
At it, it's about the length of your hair.
Oh, right, that's not very...
when I had hair. But it was such a... One can't imagine, you know, the Stones going to America. When did you last wash your hair? The Beatles the same.
They were the questions.
What do you call your haircut? Arthur. You know, it was a big hula, you know, boys sent home from school for having hair too long and all of this.
So inevitably, the rock and roll that brings you to London, and this is where you kind of make it big as a journalist, is that right? But I read somewhere you were driving a bread van.
I drove a bread van for a while, yeah.
Around the streets of London, but going to gigs.
Yeah, well, you see, the bread place, the bakery, was just off Wardour Street, just a few steps down from the Marquee. So my shift started at midnight, so I could go to the Marquee and see Jimi Hendrix, this is literal, and then go and drive the bread van, you know.
Around Soho.
Yeah. And but I was hopeless driving a bread van. I told them it was a fib. I said I used to drive bands around, you know. And the first day I crashed it. But they didn't mind and they wanted then to give me a raise. And that's where I realised that I had to leave, you know.
This wasn't for you.
I had this idea. At the time, a lot of people were wearing military uniforms, you know, like from the Crimea and all of that stuff.
The Royal Hussars.
And by law, you're not allowed to wear the king or the queen's uniform unless you have some sort of entitlement to it. So these people are actually breaking the law. So I rang up Newsweek and I said, look, there's a story here. And then I ended up interviewing, you know, Keith Richard and Roy Wood from The Move and Pete Townsend, all with these uniforms, you know.
And that landed in Newsweek?
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
You knew how to spot a yarn.
I knew how to weave one.
So you're writing this, and this is around the time you appear on Top of the Pops with John Lennon. How does that
No, this is actually, I'm talking about 1966, because what happened was I fled back to Ireland.
Oh, right.
Christmas.
Yeah.
People realised I was here, offered me all kinds of stuff. So I went with it for a while, and then I sort of returned for a second invasion in 1969. And people said, you're crazy, man. You could have a career. You know, you could be Pat Kenny or you could be Gay Byrne or whatever, you know.
I said, no, I want to go over and hang out with the Beatles.
It's very complimentary, but I prefer to go on my own wanderings, you know.
And so it is around 1970, is it, when the John Lennon...
That was 1970, yeah.
How does that happen?
I was in the dressing room with him at Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
We were having a chinwag. I gave him a copy of Capella, which was the sort of booklet that my brother Peter Fallon and Eamon Carr put out. They called themselves Tara Telephone. It was a poetry and music group. So I gave the Capella to him with the drawing. And the two of them looking at it was like they were like children. So chuffed, you know, you'd think it was the front of time or something. It was just a squiggly John Lennon type drawing, but, you know. I'm full of admiration for my brother Peter. He kind of, at Phil's request, sort of tutored him in rhymes and structure and all of that stuff. This is Peter Fallon, my brother.
Yeah.
And indeed he edited Phil's first book, Songs for While I'm Away.
Wow.
You know, so Phil would go to these poetry music readings and very nervously read out some of his lyrics, you know.
Really? Very nervously? Yeah.
Well, meaning it, man, you know.
Yes, yes, I see what you mean.
And being incredibly nervous as well at the same time.
So the relationship with John Lennon obviously flourishes, doesn't it?
Well, It's not like he'd ring me up at 4 o'clock and saying, I've got a TV show. I'm going to go and see Oliver Callan tomorrow. What should I wear? You know, it wasn't that kind of thing. It's just at one point or several points, our lives kind of overlapped. Mm-hmm. Now, if I had heroes, which I don't, John Lennon would be a main man, no question.
Really, main one?
You know, no, not necessarily the main one, but certainly would be one of the heroes.
Did you always prefer John over Paul?
I never got into that, you know. I mean, the end result was incredible, Beatles, you know. And I was never like, do you like the Stones or the Beatles? I like them both, you know. But to some people, that was a sin, you know.
It was.
But really, the image of the Stones and the Beatles, the images, were really the other way round, you know. The Beatles were sort of the cheeky chappies with the quip and all of that. Mm. And the Stones were dirt, you know. but actually, the Beatles could have been the Stones and Rora.
Yes. Okay. They went a different direction.
Epstein sort of tidied them up a bit, yes, you know.
Yeah, the tidying, yeah.
I was lucky enough to see them the last time they played at the Cavern.
Really?
August the 23rd, 1963. And there was still the tail end of them being the rock and roll, you know.
Yeah.
Here's one for Margie. I'm sorry your head, I didn't work out. That kind of thing, you know. Yeah.
And we're still almost local.
Yeah, well, they were local. I said to some girl, you must be really proud, you know. She said, oh, well, the problem is I think they're going to move to London and they won't be ours anymore, you know.
She was right
in a way. So they felt that this group that was their group was being taken away, you know.
But they wouldn't have been the world's group if they hadn't started there.
No.
You've mentioned in a lot of interviews that, you know, when you've said so many of your peers aren't around anymore, you were a rock and roll survivor. Was there huge days of excess?
Not normally in the daytime.
Times, nocturnal adventures.
Possibly.
You were on the Late Late Show a couple of times. A
few times, yeah.
With Mr. Byrne.
The first time was to be sort of examined, by Gay Byrne, you know, what is this thing?
And, curiosity.
Yeah. And there was an actor there, Joe Lynch, who was a well-known actor at the time.
Glenn Rowe, yeah.
Who was very patronising, you know. And he said, hey, Sonny, and I said, hey, Daddy, and all the audience laughed. And then I knew it was all right.
You called him Daddy when he called you Sonny.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
I have a clip from, I think it's 1983, so I don't know how many late-lates deep you are into your career at this stage, but it's about hotel room antics rock and roll.
Rearranging the furniture.
Yeah. Now, you're a very mannerly, gentle, courteous person, for as long as I've known you. Very mannerly and gentle and courteous, and yet you've mixed with a lot of these people who are pretty rough. I mean, the stories about touring with rock and roll bands and all of that sort of thing, that they wreck hotels and they do strange things. Were you ever present when any of those things happened, like wrecking hotel rooms?
I must say I've done a bit of it myself, you know.
Oh, have you? Yes. Mm. Like what?
Well, doors would be removed from hinges, or TVs might go out the window, or you might put jelly in the bath the night before you checked out.
Jelly in the bath. Why would you put jelly in the bath?
Because it hardens, you see.
Oh, you put jelly in and pour the water in and mix
it.
And then it solidifies.
Yeah. Or down the loo.
I see.
They have to dig it out. But that would only be in the hotels that treat you badly, you know.
So if they treated you badly, you'd do little tricks like that.
Well, it's yin and yang, you know.
Yeah, yin and yang.
If they're gonna give you some bad boogaloo, well, they're gonna get a poke back.
Yeah, so they had to come and dig the jelly out of the bath. What a merry.
But I mean, it wasn't sort of malicious or wicked or anything.
Television sets out of windows, especially if you're 15 stories up, that's pretty malicious.
Well, you'd make sure there was no one underneath first.
Ah, how kind.
All the sins of my youth.
The bold BP Fallon, you're getting scolded there.
What can I say? I'm in no way endorsing rearranging the furniture or indeed having it external to the hotel. But things happen, particularly after a gig, you know. If the girls haven't arrived, what are you going to do, you know? And yes, it happened on occasion. Was it a good thing? In the heat of the hunt, it doesn't matter. We're here, it's fine. You know.
We kind of expect it in rock and roll of the day.
Well, I mean, there was one gig.
40 plus years ago.
There was one gig and the hotel manager, this place where you could fish out the window, I forget what it was called. And Peter Grant, the manager of Led Zeppelin, was paying off the hotel manager, and he said, God, I often thought I'd love to throw a television out the window. And then Peter gave him £500 and said, there, have one on us. And off he went and threw the TV on us.
But checked happily before.
But there was no one underneath, yes. Very kind of me.
In your PR days, is that mostly in the 80s when you're representing... you know, Bob Geldof, Mark Bolan.
That'd be 70s.
The
really.
70s, yeah. Because it's T-Rex and Mark Bolan.
Yeah.
What did you do for Bob Geldof, for instance?
He said, fuck all.
see what I'm saying, okay.
Well, the first thing, first of all, I was very attracted to this guy, how garrulous he was and what a pop music fan he was. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing was, well, we've got to get them on television. So I rang up Mark Bolan, bless him, with who I'd worked with T-Rex, and I talked about it, and he said, will they be big? I said, yes, they will be. So he said, fine, they're on the show. Ring Jeff and sort out a date. You know, so that got them on the television. That was sort of opening the door. I said to Bob at one point, I said, if in the future I say your name and people say I'm name-dropping, then I'll know I've done my gig right.
Okay.
Now, little did we know about Live Aid and Self Aid, and do they know
still
it's
going
Christmas?
Strong? 40th anniversary,
yeah,
still a big thing. You met everybody. Tell us about Bob Dylan's handshake.
Oh, Bob Dylan had wet fish handshake, but then he's got better things to do than shaking hands. And
I imagine he doesn't do it anymore
with great ability.
Yeah,
you know, I'm full of admiration for Bob Dylan, and his work lately has been fabulous. He seems to be on the road all the time.
Yeah.
The never-ending tour. But that's his prerogative, you know.
Frowning at us with his genius.
I saw him here in Dublin when he played with the band.
Yeah.
Luke Kelly of the Dubliners.
Really?
He used to sing Dylan songs at the Embankment in Tala, you know. And he'd get a magazine called Sing Out, which was a sort of folk magazine booklet. I'd have Dylan's lyrics in it. And he'd sing them to Irish airs because he didn't know the tunes. Now, at the same time in New York, Bob Dylan was hanging out with the Clancy brothers,
yes.
Particularly Liam.
Yeah.
And he was getting Irish airs from them, i.e. the Patriot Game. Mm-hmm. It's the same tune as With God on Our Side.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same, you know.
Yeah.
So what was happening in New York was also happening here without the people knowing, you know.
Luke Kelly and Bob Dylan. In the same world. The late, great Sinead O'Connor, she rang you up one time, didn't she? She was writing her memoirs, I think.
She rang up and said, would I mind if she named me as someone who gave her acid one time and told her, and would she be allowed to tell the story? I said, if you don't name me, I'll be really upset. You know. I mean, there was this thing, there was some quiz show over there in the radio, the TV bit of here, and it was meant to be funny, sort of. And one of the comedians said, now, what's marijuana? And I went, that! And pulled out a lump of hash out of my pocket. And everyone thought that was hilarious. And then after the show, the producer said, don't worry, we'll cut that bit out. And I said, I'm very worried. I don't want you to cut that bit out because I'll have to take legal action for distorting my public image if you do. And for a few years around Ireland, I'd go and people would say, there you go, man. You know.
It was left in.
It was left in the programme, yeah.
I'm sorry to shock you, but those drugs are illegal and they're still illegal, BP Fallon.
What? Caffeine?
Marijuana and the likes. Although somehow we've managed to all live long enough to see Fianna Fáil announce they're going to decriminalise it, but that was in an election.
Well, bad bloody time. You know, apart from its uses as a recreational thing, it's very helpful for people who have certain afflictions.
Well, it is licensed now for medical purposes, but it's the smoking that causes all sorts of psychotic illnesses,
well,
unfortunately.
The thing is that in America, where they've made it legal in some places, nearly all, the state gets a third of the lollipop.
But the black market is still thriving, unfortunately, because it's cheaper.
Yeah.
And people believe it's better.
But the thing is, just because it's legal doesn't mean you have to do it. You know, just because there's a pair of scissors in your kitchen at home doesn't mean you stab the dog, you know.
Don't do that, please.
So no one's obliged to do anything. If you go to Amsterdam, you don't see, oh, look, there's all these people off their head.
No, we're in the art galleries. We're in the art galleries, of course.
So I think it should be legalised here.
Come here, BP, can I ask you about music today? Do you follow what's happening? I think you went to that Pogues celebration, didn't you?
I saw the Pogues on Tuesday.
Lots of new artists there.
No. Yes, there were. They contributed enormously well.
The Mary Wallopers.
Yes, and I'm to try the chaps, Kneecap, I think a couple of them were there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some really good stuff happening. Imelda May is someone that I'm a huge fan of.
God,
I think she's fantastic. She's the heart of the Liberties, and she's so talented. She's the only person I know who's written a poem about Etta James. Etta James is a fine folks, a rhythm and blues singer. Folks.
Great blues, yeah.
You know, she was in the play, The Mother of All the Beans.
Yes, that's fantastic. Right. I was chatting to her before that. Yeah,
fantastic. Yeah,
great performance.
And Jeff Beck, who is known to have great singers, you know, Rod Stewart was the first one, chose her when he played, he did the showcase in London, and she's singing with him. I think she's enormously talented and also very nice.
Kamir, there's lots of talk over the years of you doing memoirs.
Yes.
You say it repeatedly. Is that happening? Are you writing?
Believe it or not, it is.
Okay.
I'm kind of astounded. When will it come out?
When will it
happen? No idea. You know. I have no idea.
Are you facing a big birthday soon, can I inquire?
Not that I'm aware of. Mine? No. Yeah. Yours?
Yeah, I'm 44 in a week's time.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, happy 44. You're only a baby.
And happy, you're late 70s, are you?
I'm 78.
Well, 78, oh, you have a bit to go.
I mean, I find it incredible. Because when I was younger, 78 is like over the hills and far away, you know. 21 was old, you know.
Yeah, of
at
course,
one point
yeah.
when you're 17
you're right,
or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I think to myself, which I don't too much about this, but that in 2 years I'll be 80, I'm just like amazed and thankful, you know. And what I'm doing now, making music, I love. I absolutely love it, and writing songs, and, you know, I've always got my little notebook here, you know, to scribble stuff in. But I've had this before I started making music.
And you're,
and I've
you've
gone through
you're
some
writing even today, I see. You've got notes.
Yes, I do.
You did Jack White has recorded stuff with you, with David Holmes as well.
Yes.
It was a thing I listened to yesterday, increasingly often.
Right.
And that's a song. I don't unfortunately have enough time to play the whole thing. I'll give people a little flavour.
Oh, Jim said you were going to play it all.
Oh, that was the plan. But you see, you gave me too many anecdotes.
Too much.
Yeah. You gave me too many brilliant anecdotes.
Okay, well, this is
a very hopeful song. It's a very cheerful one.
Well, it's about life and death, basically.
Yeah.
But I was writing, I wrote the lyrics, and then my friend Aaron, who's in the Bandits, came round and I said, look, I've got this song here. It starts off increasingly often. I'll change that, you know. And he said, why? I said, well, I don't know why. So he kept it increasingly often.
It's gorgeous. BP Fallon, thank you so much for the conversation.
Oh, is that it already?
I'm going to play you out with a clip.
Wow.
Actually, before I do that, I wanted to give you some lovely messages coming in.
Oh.
It's good to hear beeps, dulcet tones in the radio. That's what they call you. Your friends call you beep.
Yeah.
What does the BP stand for, by the way?
Bernard Patrick John O'Brien Fallon.
Oh, that's quite a
short,
lot.
You know.
Bernard Patrick. Your radio show opened this person's eyes as a teen. God bless you, BP. Another one. It's so wonderful to hear BP in your show. He's so much part of the fabric of us Irish rockers. Please wish BP and all your listeners the gift of peace, the gift of love, and the gift of rock and roll.
Oh, thank you. Who's that?
They don't give the name.
Well, thank you, Mr. Or lady, no name.
Oh, no. My favourite memory of BP is on a talent show many, many years ago as a judge. He practically told the parents of two young children, take them home, let them be children. I loved it. Wise words, but some people didn't understand it. Stay strong, BP. That's Rose in Crosshaven. Hi, BP. I cycled home with you in the mid-1980s from Merrion Square to the top of Temple Hill in Blackrock late at night. A great chat. Musical education for me, says Bill.
Hiya, Bill.
Thank you for the musical education.
Oliver, thank you for having me.
Happy Christmas to
you. In your esteemed area.
And I'm looking forward to the memoir.
Happy Christmas, happy everything.
You should call it after this, increasingly often.
Increasingly often, I'm thinking how I love you. And I always did too. Each and every moment is a special one. Not just some of them. Every moment is nearer to the end. Not in a bad way, not in a sad way. It's just that time does not go on.